Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics and another episode of the Deep Focus series from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic policy think tank. My name is Sean Gibson, I'm Bruegel's press officer, and today I'll be talking to Bruegel fellow Suman Berry, who has written a research paper on the G20 on the 10th anniversary of its existence. Hello, Suman.
Hello.
Thank you for joining me. So as we do with the Deep Focus series, we'll be getting a little better acquainted with Bruegel's research and its key talking points. So it's good to begin by saying that this paper is looking specifically at the aim to coordinate national economic policies that was a key agenda item from the beginning of the G20, but also that the research you've done pays particular attention to the experience of G20 member countries that have been classed as emerging and developing economies by the IMF. So if we perhaps start quite broadly, Suman, what have you found the G20 has achieved in its 10 years?
Sean, I think the answer to that is mixed. Let me start for your audience just to recap what we're talking about when we talk about the G20. We are actually talking about something called the G20 Leaders Summit. So what happened in 2008, which is why we're at the 10-year mark, is that in the absolute panic following the collapse of Lehman Brothers, I believe it was President George W. Bush, together with some European leaders, who felt that restoring calm in the markets really required heads of government to come together. You should know, or the listeners should know, that the choice of 20 countries, actually 19 countries, and the European Union had been made a decade earlier at the time of what economists call the Asian financial crisis. At that point, it was at the level of finance ministers and it was fairly technocratic. I think what we're commemorating now is what has been achieved by bringing in heads of government. And that's really what the paper is about. So should I go on and answer your question?
Indeed, please.
Right. Well, I spent a lot of time in my reading and in the paper deciding what were indeed the right indicators, the right metrics for deciding how to assess a shifting group of national politicians. And I would make a few points. The G20 leaders were born in crisis, and they have kept saying that they should be judged on the contribution that their conclaves have made to restoring what they call sustainable and balanced growth. So those are the indicators they have put forward to us. I should also make the point that the world of 2018 is a very different world from the world of 2008 when they first met. And I think to hold them to a set of standards that were articulated in 2008 may not be entirely appropriate. So what we have is a shifting group of people, because after all, except in certain countries, leaders don't stay there for 10 years, dealing with a dynamic situation, both economic and political. So I think the broad answer in the paper is that it's a mixed record. I think there is consensus that in the white heat of the crisis, when they first got together, and they got together twice a year for the first 2 years, the trick worked. I think the fact that they were all pulling together, getting together, the Chinese, the Russians, the Indians, the Americans, helped reassure markets that that the bottom wasn't going to fall out. And that was really quite important psychologically. Now, if you were to ask analysts, was it things they did or asked to be done decisive? A lot of people, and there's been a lot of commentary this in the last few months, in the run-up to the anniversary of the Lehman crisis, you know, people would say actually it was a decisive action in the United States by the Federal Reserve, which quantitatively was important. But market psychology does matter. So there was a sequence from what the American Fed did to the leaders coming together in the summit of November 2008 to a very significant meeting in London that took place in May of 2009. So all of that very much helped to, as it were, break the fall, I think. I think we then get into a second phase where, and I spent quite a bit of time on this in the paper, where to some extent complacency stepped in. And we can talk about why that was. A lot of the, if you like, disillusionment with the way leaders were managing the post-crisis economies set in that period. And I'm talking here about 2010 to about 2016, which was, of course, the depth of the euro crisis as well. And parenthetically, I should perhaps say that Europe is overrepresented in the G20. So quite apart from the fact that the European Union itself is a member, four member states are members as well. And then you have the period since Donald Trump came, in which period we have had only one summit, which was in Hamburg last year. And there will be the summit in Buenos Aires that will be taking place at the end of November. So when I say that they took the eye off the ball in that middle period, I think the proof of that pudding is in where we are. I mean, if this was a group whose goal was to reassure their populations that globalization was good for them, I would say certainly in the advanced democracies, they actually made a rather poor fist of it, to be honest. Let me then say that the whole experiment of bringing in countries like India, China, Brazil to the top table, which is why in your introduction, you talked about our paying particular interest attention to the emerging and developing economies. That was or is so unprecedented, novel, bold, that I think one has to cut a certain amount of slack and really ask, okay, since that was such a massive step, should we allow for the fact that that accommodating that took some time.
Just to go back to a point you made, why do you think complacency crept in after the first couple of years and of what you termed to be reasonable success?
Well, the analysis in the paper the analysis I did for the paper and the reading I did for the paper suggests a number of answers to that question. Firstly, even though the novelty of the G20 was the inclusion of large but poor economies, I think the evidence is, the record shows, that they were wary, and I'll come to why they might have been wary, about putting their hands up. I mean, they like being at the top table, but I think a criticism of them is, okay, you've got to the top table, but, you know, what's your agenda? And that's taken time. I think, though, the consequence of that, then, is that the debates, dare I call them the fights that took place, were amongst the rich countries, which we call the G7. And there was sharp polarization about why the crisis had come about and what needs to be done about it. And sitting here in Brussels, you know, many of these debates also surrounded the euro crisis. Essentially, there were very different economic models of why the crisis had taken place and whether what economists would call Keynesian policies or fiscal stimulus had a role to play. And I think maybe complacency is too strong a word. So there was a sense that the bottom had been reached. And then people were very concerned, and rightly so. I mean, these were issues of intellectual conviction, that they didn't want to add the same fuel, as they saw it, to the fire that as had lit the fire in the first place. Debt, fiscal stimulus, etc. And it was the case not only in this crisis, but it has been the case in other banking crises as well, that for a whole range of reasons, the debt to GDP ratio tends to shoot up. Revenues go down, a lot of the duff assets of the banking system have to be taken up by the state. And so just by virtue of the crisis, countries had ended up with sovereign debt levels that they found frightening. So maybe complacency was the wrong word. There was a sense that now, that if the debt spiral had been arrested, now sustainability had to take over. But there were very different views of sustainability. And I think what we have seen in very different parts of the world, particularly the difference between Southern Europe and Northern Europe as compared to the United States, that pause has cast quite a long shadow forward, to the point where, you know, now that the global economy is in pretty good health, that hasn't stanched the trend towards populism, the political sort of aftermath.
So why do you think that the poorer members of the G20 have been quite so passive? Is that tied into the point you've made about the spiking debt, or is there more to it than that?
I think it's been difficult to get the same amount of commentary coming out of the emerging markets as the advanced economies because, I've looked for it. There's perhaps a bit too much in there reflecting the views of people from my own country, India. I mean, I'm a non-resident fellow of Bruegel, but I'm based in India, and I had access to several generations of Indians who have participated in G20 meetings. I want to answer that question by reflecting on really quite how much has changed in this decade or in the last 20 years. It's a commonplace to say that the weight of the emerging economies in the world has changed sharply. And it is also the case that when the advanced economies were sort of flat on the back, it was the fact that India and China and to some extent Brazil were able to continue growing that compensated for the loss of demand from the rich countries. But the important point is that the self-image of, let's take my own country, which is the poorest member of the G20 of India, is that we are a struggling developing country with important, an important domestic agenda, and that you know, we are willing, in a sense, to be what economists call free riders on the system. But this is particularly true of India and China, that the sheer weight of population means that these are now becoming large economies, and in the case of China, a very large trading power. And so they become systemically important, even though they remain poor. And so I would say that there is a concern that more might be asked of them than they feel politically able to deliver. And so that's one reason for being passive. That's the first point I'd make, or it's a point in the paper. And a second point I would make is that the G7 component of the rich countries, there are a couple of rich countries who are not members of the G7, notably Australia and also South Korea. But the G7 have been working together, Sean, since about 1975. They may not always get agree, but there's a very, very thick, or has been until President Trump, set of informal institutions for consultation. The newcomers don't yet have that. And while there was a grouping called the BRICS, I think that they are to some extent rivals. So I think it's a question of inexperience as much as anything else. And really not getting used to the fact that being poor doesn't obviate the reality that you're big, okay? And indeed, at a Bruegel workshop not so long ago, I talked to somebody who'd been a senior British civil servant, and he was rather despairing that the G20 could work with countries of such different political systems, levels of per capita income. So it's a giant experiment, I would say. And that's why I'm at least prepared to give it a bit more time.
You've spoken about a shift since 2016 with the election of President Trump in the United States. There is potentially with the growing American preference perhaps for bilateral trade rather than the multilateral system that has existed, for somebody else or another group to step into the breach. Now, is the G20 possibly one form in which that vacuum can be filled if the US is stepping away, and how might that be? How might that be done? What might that look like?
Let's be clear what the G20 is and isn't, and then let me attempt an answer to your question. So the G20 at the summit level is a bunch of leaders who provide political direction to then their national technocrats, their national civil servants, or not necessarily civil servants. Finance ministers are not civil servants, but their national apparatus. And through the national apparatus, transmit signals to the international organizations. So the first question is, or the important question is, how is that transmission belt affected if there is dissonance at the political level? And we saw the first demonstration of this at the Hamburg summit. I should perhaps say that at the Hamburg summit, the issue on the table was climate change, and President Trump had wanted to opt out. And there was language in the communique, which is the ultimate expression of the political will of these 19 or 20 jurisdictions. So there was language to indicate that the other 18 or other 19, including the European Union, felt this way and one member felt another way. And by the way, this wasn't the first time that language allowed for the lack of consensus. Okay. So there's the issue of the form that these differences might take, but then there is the much more important question of who will construct coalitions, as were constructed in the case of the Paris Agreement on climate change, which actually also came out of, to some extent, the G20. And that takes leadership. So the question then becomes, has the whole apparatus become so dependent on American leadership that if that leadership is not present, that somebody else will step up to the plate? When you combine that concern or observation with what I've said about the poorer members being a little hesitant, I'm thinking now more of China than my own country over here, I think it depends on the depth of threat perception. And yet, I think when the Buenos Aires summit happens, I think firstly, we will see whether President Trump shows up. I expect him to. He showed up at Hamburg. Secondly, with the World Trade Organization, the WTO, really being one of the most challenged institutions of the old structure, talking to people who were at the last ministerial, which was also in Buenos Aires a year ago, they said the Americans did show up and were constructive. Let me also say, by accident or maybe by design, the Buenos Aires G20 summit, when it takes place on November 30th, will have taken place after the American midterm elections. And so to the extent that there's a certain amount of posturing that's going on, and nothing wrong with it, it's a functioning democracy, then it may well be that the stance of President Trump and of his ministers might be more emollient. So a lot could happen.
When we look at the, we've already talked about the EU's presence within the G20 being significant. Recently, in the last couple of years, we've seen the EU moving to sign large free trade agreements, and we've heard Commission President Juncker talk about expanding the role of the euro internationally. What potential then is there for the EU to provide leadership to the G20, not only to strengthen themselves but to strengthen the G20 as a group?
I think the potential is quite large. That said, these observations that I heard from Europeans I interviewed for the paper, Europe also has to demonstrate that it is willing to make adjustments to accommodate the changed world in which we find ourselves. Let me give you a small example. In addition to its overrepresentation in the G20, the Europeans have tended to be overrepresented in the board of the IMF. Now, somebody very senior, and I was surprised to hear it coming from him, said that, look, you know, members of the Eurozone, and obviously this excludes Britain, even before Britain decided to exit the EU, really have no business, or they ought not to be insisting in a monetary organization, an international monetary organization, that they represent individual member states when practically, both in monetary policy and in bank supervision, all of these functions have been allocated to the ECB. But, you know, it's a job of work that somebody is going to have to take up, perhaps after the next parliamentary election in Europe, to persuade, you know, and here I'm not talking of only four member states. I mean, you've got the, there's been some reduction in the number of chairs, but you had Italians, Belgians, Dutch, etc., everybody holding board seats at the IMF. So I think that, and I'm not saying that the U.S. is squeaky clean. I mean, the U.S. has insisted, again, in the board of the fund, that it retain a veto right. And so any change in the articles of agreement has to run the gauntlet of a U.S. veto. So I think, and I don't want to strain the patience of your audience too much longer, I think really what I'm saying is that the world has changed a lot. The G20 is a forum for bringing together a group of leaders who have an interest in developing a new set of rules, but it has to be a set of rules and practices which are more ecumenical, which are more reflective of the shift in economic power that's taking place. But ultimately, this is a gathering of national leaders, and what is the English phrase? You know, turkeys praying for Christmas. Well, you know, there's going to be an element of that as well.
Yeah. Well, with that, I think we can bring the curtain down on this episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening in to this Deep Focus. And thank you very much, Suman, for joining me and walking us through your research.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If you would like to survey some more of Bruegel's work, we have a range of publications, blog posts, and other podcast episodes available on our website, www.bruegel.org. We hope you've enjoyed listening to The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.